Hey everyone, and welcome back to Purple Row Radio. My name is Greg Stanwood. I'm a staff writer at Purple Row. I'm here along with the headache-ridden staff, chief editor of Purple Row, Andrew Martin.
The managing editor, Greg.
Yes, that's what I usually say.
What you usually say is, supreme potentate or all the varieties of, leadership titles that you've been coming up with lately.
I only did that for like 2 weeks because unfortunately there aren't too many good ones until you start sounding like you don't know what you're talking about. But I sounded like that anyway. Fantastic.
Overlord's a good one, and you can kind of sound like you know what you're talking about when you say Overlord.
When Russ was on the show last year, I called him the Overlord.
How did he like that?
I couldn't tell.
Good old Russ and his, lack of emotion.
Exactly.
Or something like that.
Well, we're going to try to have a pretty short show because neither of us is feeling great, but we don't really have a whole lot to talk about in terms of the team's performance this past week. It's really just been more of the same. But we have seen a couple more roster swaps coming along. Last week we discussed Morales and Paulino. Paulino ended up getting traded to the Royals since we had that podcast. Earlier in the week, we saw the team actually did cut Jose Lopez from the roster, which, as I explained in the post I put up about it, I was a little surprised by. I don't know about you, but what were your thoughts on that?
Well, it seemed a bit sudden, but at the same time, we've said this a million times that if the guys up at the top of the lineup, the guys we expect to be performing are performing, a lot of the scrutiny will be taken off the bench. And that just seems to be, the timing of things, that the scrutiny was suddenly entirely on the bench, even though it, not necessarily should have, but these are all the guys who are obviously playing for their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to have a...
They are the easiest to cut.
Precisely. So, in that stern eye there, a couple of the newcomers were, I can't think of the word for it. They put all the cards on the table. They were rent open for all to view, and Lopez just was not cutting it. He was getting, I would say, better. He batted like 330 or something like that the week before he got DFA'd, but too little, too late, man. And the fact that they were all still singles, it just leads you to think that it was a hot streak.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily a turnaround, because he wasn't hitting for any power either. I mean, Lord knows he wasn't walking. And it makes a lot of people, kind of look bad. Wink, nudge, nudge, rocks girl, 920 OPS. Yeah. But a lot of people just in the general Lopez camp, and a lot of camps, the people saying, oh, he's going to come around, he's going to come around. The ever-hopeful potential seers, they, myself being one of them, and by seer, I really just mean, hoper and gambler.
Right.
And, there's a lot of good reasons to try to look at Lope, to try to let him fight it out and make the acquisition of those good things. But, ultimately this one just turned around and bit us, and, we lose on that one. Tough. After a while, it seems to be like a chain of events of like, oh, this experiment didn't work. Well, this experiment didn't work either. Oh, look, the Rockies traded for Jose Lopez. Another experiment. Well, you gotta be able to take flyers on guys like these. When you don't have a trustworthy prospect or someone, just ready to slide right in and take the job, you kinda have to, be a bit creative. And Lopez had the kind of profile that said, hey, I might be able to turn myself around in Coors Field, refine my stroke, and get myself out of the funk that Safeco put me in, but it's just kind of the wrong team to, I guess, try for too many of these experiments. And with Lopez, he needed to put up or shut up for a team that's in contention, or supposed to be in contention. They have to be, getting production from everywhere, and Lopez was, not part of the place, one of the places that gave production. So it's a tough choice, and tough to give up, and tough to swallow the fact that you took that gamble and blew it.
Mm-hmm.
Lopez got the axe, and, I don't really feel bad about it. He wasn't with the team that long. I think he, there's still something there. You saw some sparks of power and stuff like that, but he's just out there flailing and guessing at this point, and I don't know if that was always his game, even when he was doing well, and he just maybe had two lucky seasons. Seems odd to say, but maybe that's what it was, because we hadn't seen him do anything like that since then. So, yeah, bummer. What you gonna do? Here we are.
Yeah, again, for me, it was mostly just I had expected Amezaga to go first, and of course Amezaga was designated today. So they did end up doing that. They, of course, brought up Eric Young and Chris Nelson, both of whom need a chance to prove themselves as quickly as possible, because coming into next year, they are not going to have they're both going to be out of options, for one thing. So basically, I mean, they're at the point where they need to prove their way into the organization's future before they start considering them trade options or have to let them go via waivers or something like that. But again, for me, and I mean, some people would probably chalk this up to because I was one of the first people, as I recall. In fact, I think I mentioned Lopez last year at like the trade deadline as somebody to look at. I wasn't really huge on the train, but at the same time, I wanted them to get him as a bench player. And I think people are going to think that I'm just saying that I'm surprised they let him go just because I wanted to hope that Lopez would, you know, turn it around and I could brag about it. But that's really not the case. It just kind of came out of nowhere. I thought they were going to give him at least until the All-Star break or so. And I mean, he kind of got hurt by the fact not only that, he was never really clear on whether he was going to be on the bench or whether he was going to be starting. I think when they first got him, their intention was, or their thoughts were potential bench guy. And then as we started to get the second base, as our eyes kind of shifted or the organization's attention sort of shifted that way, it became clear kind of going into the spring that he was going to be the favorite to land that job, and he ended up doing it. And, you know, pretty quickly lost it there. So that coupled with the fact that, you know, we weren't getting a whole lot of production from some of the places he can play, like third base, for example. And, you know, he didn't have a lot of good things on his resume with the team. So while I'm not, I wouldn't describe my surprise as the move doesn't make sense, but I would have assumed they would have waited. And I don't think they would have been wrong necessarily to wait. And my big worry would be, you know, the organization is hearing all these complaints like, you know, this team is going nowhere and we need to start making moves, and they feel compelled to make moves just for the sake of making moves. That's what my concern would be here. Because
which isn't totally a valid concern too. I mean, we have actually seen the Rockies be very, very patient up in, you know, with all these kinds of moves up until, you know, just recently. I mean, a lot of things, you know, like signing contracts, they were obviously a bit overambitious on, if you look at Manny Corpus, for example. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, they've, you know, handled trades, handled, you know, releases and stuff like that relatively slowly and cautiously with certain players. With some, I mean, like 2007, you saw John Mabry and Steve Finley both get DFA'd pretty quick there.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess with a guy like Jose Lopez, who had a $3.6 million salary as compared to Mabry and Finley, who I'm guessing had incentive laden contracts that really cost the team, you know, $750 or something like that.
Right.
With Lopez, you know, I don't disagree with the idea that they should have left him in the lineup and just let him keep trying to hit his way out of it up until the break, but you're probably right with the idea that the team is panicking a little bit. But at the same time, you know, you had first place in the division for the month of April and, you know, a few days in May, and then now you're in third, and
mm-hmm.
it's yeah. So you're right. There are a lot of expectations coming their way, but I really do question what Lopez is going to do going forward. I figure his numbers would start to peak up eventually. And then, you know, who knows, maybe there would have been, you know, a big September hero story to go with Jose Lopez. But at the same time, you know, if we got guys tearing it up in the springs and we're supposed to be trying to win these things, you got to put the best 25 in the field. And I am not entirely sure that Jose Lopez was one of the top 25 in the organization anymore.
And he certainly may not have been. Of course, I think that the skeptic in me looks at what Young and Nelson were doing at AAA, and saying, you know, that's not necessarily proof that they're going to be that answer either.
Well, the thing with Nelson, though, is I don't understand the move of Nelson unless we're just looking. I mean, he's on the 40, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, cause obviously, yeah, he's on the 40. After all, he's out of options, too, isn't he? You said earlier this is his last option. Yeah, that's right.
Right. Young and Nelson can be optioned through the rest of the year. After that, they have to be up with the team or they have to hit waivers, which is what I was basically saying. With these two guys, it comes down to giving them the opportunity now to make a statement for their future with us. Basically, because if neither of them really secures a spot, whether it's as a utility player or as a starter, you know, we are not going to be keeping them.
Well, Young's gotten a hit in his three games up so far, which is really doesn't mean anything. It's a three-game sample, but his numbers were phenomenal in the springs.
Absolutely. I think he deserved a call-up, for sure.
Agreed.
Sure.
And I'm hoping that, you know, out of all the guys in the organization, I would probably bet on Eric Young to prove everyone wrong, more than Johnny Herrera, more than, you know, Jose Lopez, more than Matzik, whatever failed-looking prospect we have. I bet you anything, Eric Young would be the one to surprise you out of all of them, and there'd be absolutely no reason to explain it. When people talk about late bloomers and stuff like that, I really think, I mean, because he's done this at every level. Every level they say you're probably done. I mean, not just come into the dugout and say, hey, Young, right, you're not going to make it past Modesto. You're doomed. But more along the lines of, you know, Scott's like, well, we see a lot of problems in Eric Young with his speed and on-base abilities, but the reality of it is that he's probably done in a high A ball or whatever. He's gotten that kind of those reviews every single level, and maybe there's a bit of organizational nepotism, what with Eric Young hitting that one home run that one time. But still, he's the fact that he's showing up in every single level is just a testament to his work ethic, and hopefully it's his work ethic and not just his dad forcing it upon him, because I was reading an article on him, and they're literally saying that Eric Young had eyes everywhere and was watching EYJ at, you know, every level of his development, which came off as a bit creepy, but at the same time, you know, you're not going to get away with anything that way.
Especially when you put it into the context of that commercial from last year.
Oh, yeah. Hey, Boo-Boo! You forgot Boo-Boo! And Wooby! You did not just do that. Anyways, now Young coming to AAA last year was like, the skills are there, and maybe he just, so they called him up when he was really bad, and then he did not start the season with the team this year, and then he looks like he fixed whatever was broken yet again, and found a way to dominate. When we say dominate, we're not just talking it's Security Service Field and Jeff Salazar hit a walk-off home run on Saturday night. We just mean he was adjusting to everything, and his home road splits were clearly skewed toward the hitter-friendly home park, but, you know, in a park adjustment kind of way, not in just a, he's Dante Bichetti, he can only hit it, you know, at home. So, but Nelson, I mean, that's a lot of talking about EYJ, considering he was the obvious move here, but I don't understand Nelson getting the call. I don't hate the guy or anything, but he's got a, I mean, I will put a caveat on this. I have not seen his home road split. So if he is a balanced hitter, unless, Greg, you have him in front of you or something.
No, I find those difficult to track down now that minor league splits is gone.
Yeah, there's a way to get him somewhere. Anyways, the point with Nelson is you look at his line, and it's a good, like, 900-plus OPS, which is great to see. But when it's a high batting average, very little walk, and a lot of power, that's pretty standard of the Colorado Springs, you know, raise an eyebrow to this line. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy might not be a total dead out in the majors, but there's a good chance that he's going to be a defensive replacement only on the road. And, you know, I'm not saying that Nelson necessarily has put up that game, because, again, not having seen splits and not having been able to watch him this season, it's a bit hard to make a totally authoritative claim, but just speaking about the stats, that looks like a Colorado Springs heavy line.
I have his splits here if you want them.
For 2011?
Yeah, what do you want?
Just his slash line.
Let's see, at home, 337 average, 373 on base percentage, 525 slugging. Away, he has a 292 average, 317 on base percentage, and 479 slugging.
So that's a pretty big drop off there, but it shows similar slash splits in there.
Mm-hmm. And it's significant, but it's also, there have been a lot of players who have moved through AAA that have that split and have turned out okay.
But still though, an 800 OPS is never anything to sneeze at any level of baseball just because it shows that a guy is a relatively balanced hitter. But it makes me wonder, you know, obviously his road numbers aren't the only numbers that matter because, I mean, come on, we're Rockies fans. We know that it's not just about road numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily think it's a line that is going to translate well to the majors. I have hope that it will because he's here and let's, God bless it, use him if someone else isn't doing their job right. But no, I think my trepidation is valid.
A lot of his numerical production is pretty much the same at home on the road. He even has more home runs away than at home. And then a lot more doubles as well, but all of his triples came at home, and I mean, that really doesn't mean anything, but the point is he is hitting in both spots.
Which is good.
Yeah.
I'm just being Debbie Downer. I'm one of the few people who is not on the free Chris Nelson bandwagon. I'd almost rather burn through guys like Brad Emos or, Josh Fields or, you know, whoever, and rather than, I guess he's an option year no matter what, though, isn't he?
Yeah, and I mean, this is, if you run down the roster and so forth, the guy he's replacing, Amezaga, is kind of a similar player. Can't do the outfield stuff, but he can cover middle infield, you know, just the same way. He'd be playing pretty much the same role, as I understand it, so.
I guess the one good thing he can potentially bring is that, I think I mentioned this on Friday's Rock Pile about how Lopez getting DFA'd created kind of an awkward infield depth situation. And, you know, Nelson for Amezaga isn't, it's kind of a lateral move in that regard. They're really just trying to check a different bat out. But, Nelson, they've played him in third and second, even though he's only played shortstop in the Springs, or at least any majority of time in the Springs was at shortstop. But, they're bringing up an infielder, not the, and with potentially a better bat. So they're trying to get they might drop off a little bit on positional versatility that they had in Amezaga and kind of get that back in batting potential because no one ever thought that Alfredo Amezaga was going to come up and light it up off the bench in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've seen some clutch bunting and, you know, hitting to the right side, but yeah.
Well, the team no longer has any excuses for keeping non-roster players off the roster now because we have four open 40-man spots. It's really funny to see in the middle of the season your 40-man roster only have 36 players. You know, one is going to go to Cook in a couple days here.
Yeah, so 37.
And then, you know, one presumably, I still assume they're going to call up Rex Brothers eventually, if it's not in a couple weeks, maybe a couple months. But that front end of the bullpen there is still kind of evolving, or back end. Which one did we decide on?
We're talking about the mop-up guys, right? Because, like, Reynolds and, Billings is already back down again, but...
Those spots, yeah, the ones that have been kind of in flux recently.
Let's call them the low leverage slots, because come on, that's what they are.
Okay, and I mean, I certainly don't mean to imply that Rex Brothers is going to be low leverage necessarily. It's just you want him to be low leverage when you first call him up.
Obviously,
same idea we had with Matt Reynolds last year, basically at the end of the year. Except we might be seeing Brothers sooner, but the organization still seems to be trying to be conservative about that. They don't want to rush him when they don't necessarily need that second lefty. But I think sooner or later that need is going to be here. Maybe it'll be June. Maybe it'll be September. But, go ahead.
Let me jump on a little tangent here. For you mentioning Matt Reynolds, he's kind of like my attaboy player of the week if we really had that kind of a thing. Just, you know, just talking about him, you know, being the late call-up last year, we knew he was there, like, you know, from the perps voting and stuff like that, but, you know, he's never really thought of as too much, just kind of a, you know, whatever, he's going to be there. And then he comes up and just starts destroying the strike zone in AAA Colorado Springs, and then called up, and he's like one of the stalwarts of the bullpen, and even when he's struggling a bit, a lot of that's also because he's a left-hander, but at the same time, no one thinks about, oh, maybe we should get rid of Matt Reynolds. No, Matt Reynolds is there, he's the guy, he's the... He's the one we love, and you know, just good for him. It just it kind of seemingly came out of the middle of the forgotten middle of the pack part of the prospect tree, and he's now you know Captain Bullpen, or Captain Matt Penn, I should say. It's kind of fun because he's only been up in with the team for like what 4 months of playing time, less than that,
something like that. I have his service time somewhere. I can
but
look
that
up.
But the point is that it's been less than a year, and he's already oh yeah, totally Matt Reynolds. No, you know, just like he's been here forever, you know.
Yeah, actually, there's one easy distinction to point out regarding some of the players on our team. There are a total of two on the current active roster who have never been optioned. Those are Troy Tulowitzki and Matt Reynolds. Which basically means that they are the two players who came up and stuck from the time they came up. So
only using a major league option, not a minor league option? Or in a sense of putting them on the 40-man but demoting them in spring training?
Right.
Has Helton ever been optioned?
Helton, well, he might have. I don't know. I guess what I mean to say is Helton doesn't have any options right now because he is, well, okay. I don't want
to expire in age or something like that.
Technically, no. I don't want to get too much into this, but it's still good educational material. Any player can theoretically be optioned, but when they pass 5 years of service time, it really doesn't matter anymore because they can just say, no, I don't want to be, and they can leave.
Yeah, that's why Lopez is almost a surefire cut.
Mm-hmm. And of course, right now they're trying desperately to trade him.
Trade him, exactly. We'll trade you for anything. We'll trade you for a bag of bats, you know, whatever.
Because even though the result from just the fan perspective, either way, is going to be Lopez is gone. If we trade him, we pay a lot less of his salary than if we release him. Because if we release him and somebody picks him up, we pay all but
the prorated league men.
Precisely. Which means $400,000 spread out across the pay period that they...
It'd be about $275,000 by this point in the season.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways... So we were, let's see, how do we get on Lopez, the DFA thing, the Todd Helton's 5, and he also has 5-10. It's, if you didn't know this already, if a player has been in the majors for 10 years with the same team for 5, they have full no trade protection. Just, that's all there is to it.
It gets added to their contract. Yeah.
Exactly. It's an automatic addition. The team kind of has no control over it. And what was, I was reading Tim Kirkchin's book a while back. Is this a great game or what? And he was, someone misquoted him, and because he was saying that the team is not going to trade him or whatever because he's a 5-10 player, and the you know the copy editor who he transmitted the article to from the ballpark or whatever, he completely misread it, and he said that the team won't be trading the player because he's 5'10".
Whoops.
Yeah, that was an interesting correction. Yeah, this team needs a short, bitey Ganigay. just a funny side note there. So,
yeah, so
point of the entire tangent was, good for you, Matt Reynolds. You keep it up, cause you got a future with this team, alright? You know?
Yeah, and I think he is definitely showing that he has a role on the team. I mean, we've been saying this since last offseason. You know, we are entering a period of organizational depth that is high on a lot of stuff, but really, really low on left-handed pitching.
Uh-huh.
And, Matt Reynolds, thankfully has stood out. And of course, this is one of the reasons that Rex Brothers has advanced so quickly. It's not just because of this need for left-handed pitching. I mean, obviously he has to have the skills and the talent to be able to move up that quickly. But at the same time, they might be laying a little bit easier on him if we had one or two more left-handed pitching prospects up across the upper levels of the minors there. But again, we're just going with Matt Reynolds right now from the left side, and when and if they decide to add Brothers, it's not going to be a problem because we have plenty of open spots. Now, the other funny thing about this, and this is just another one of those things that I like to bring up because it's just interesting to me, is there were so few players between this roster and the projected 2012 roster that would be leaving. And amusingly, the only two players on the 40-man roster that would have been free agents inherently, which were Amezaga and Lopez, are now gone. So,
yeah, go figure. So if you don't like this team, well,
So now we have Jason Giambi and Aaron Cook, who are both, they both have mutual options that are probably going to get declined. Although, with Giambi, he just seems like that one guy who never leaves, so.
Well, you never know. And I mean, I think I said this a lot in last week's podcast, or I said it to somebody, but I have to say it again. Saturday, the game we lost to the Padres and the Brad Hopp home run and the bullpen implosion and all that bad stuff, the one that was raining, they had a segment on the Jumbotron, and it was Ask the Giambino, and it was Giambi wearing this terrible, like, Swami-type style turban, and, like, this awful little short cape that looked almost like a kid's blanket or something like that, and he would just answer these ridiculous questions with even more ridiculous answers, and then swoop the cape around his shoulder dramatically, and I watched that, and I said, hey, guys, I'm with, like, 20 guys for a bachelor party. I said, guys, look at this. Dead silence along our entire row as you all just stared, like, what on earth are we looking at? And when that was over, it's kind of this, you know, a little bit of chatter, and everyone just kind of stunned for a moment. I looked at my buddy Adam, and I say, Giambi can never leave the team. Ever. Ever, ever. If this awkward roster spot thing makes that possible, that thing I just saw on the Jumbotron, I don't care. I want to see more stupid crap like that out of Jason Giambi. The guy cracks me up. Anyhow, it seems like the organization just loves him so much. If they don't hire him as a coach soon, you're right. We're going to have this perpetual, like, Julio Franco guy on our roster, and I'm okay with that because it's Jason Giambi.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. He has such a national name recognition that if you look at, like, the jerseys that fans wear around Coors Field, he's easily in the top five, even though he is one of the, I mean, and I don't mean to say this with any disrespect, I'm sure somebody will get mad, but one of the lesser important members of the current roster in Jason Giambi.
Oh, totally. I'm hoping that, Giambi's going to retire someday here. I hope that Mark Teixeira is like 38 or 39 or however old he's going to be when his contract with the Yankees expires. I hope they pick him up as the next pinch hit guy. Just because if we can keep, like, stealing, like, you know, aging Yankees contract expirees, people always be like, wow, the Rockies picked up Mark Teixeira. Let's pay slightly more attention to them now and, you know, things like that.
Okay, first, though, right, if he follows the path Giambi did, we have to Teixeira has to, like, re-sign with the Rangers for, like, for 2 months and be really bad and then get released. and then we pick him up at the end of the year as, like, a September call-up, and then he's there for another 3 years on one-year minor league deals.
maybe even if not Mark Teixeira, like, Nick Swisher. Nick Swisher would be the perfect, like, he's not as big as, obviously not as big as the big Giambino after the, you know, just the contract and the monstrous production and steroids and all that. But Swisher's like a big goofball who just fits in so perfectly with New York and stuff like that. I can just picture him being, you know, the new Giambi once, you know, he's done with his contract with the Yankees or whatever. And Swiss is a good ball player too. I would love that.
Yeah, he seems like the type who could fit in well anywhere, pretty much.
Oh yeah, I've never heard any beef about Nick Swisher from any team ever.
He's not a great actor, but I have nothing else bad to say about him.
Oh, you're talking about that terrible, like, what, Norelco ad or whatever it is? Oh my gosh. If you haven't seen this, it's Papelbon and Nick Swisher in a split screen, and they're both shaving the same razor, but apparently you can use this razor with, like, shaving cream in the shower or something. Meanwhile, on the other side, Jonathan Papelbon is shaving, dry, and they have this awful exchange, like, you know, trying to talk trash about how they use their razors, and, oh, it's just painful. And plus, I have to see Jonathan Papelbon on my TV. Ugh.
Good thing we aren't playing the Red Sox this year.
I will accept all comers. I hate Jonathan Papelbon.
But we are playing the Yankees, so we might see some Swisher.
I do like Nick Swisher. Don't I like Joba Chamberlain, though? Anyways, what on earth were we talking about?
Nick Swisher, followed by Jason Giambi.
But, yeah. And before that was, like, something about the team being the same team as next year.
Right, which we don't really need to talk about anymore. These are just amusing, related tangential factoids about the fact that our teams are going to be pretty similar.
Folks, we didn't prepare a lot of material for today, so I hope you're liking it.
Basically, everybody who was going to be gone anyway is now going in the middle of the season. And so it's just like we're already – we've already accepted that our – 2012 roster should just be our 2011 roster. Why not?
I mean, we're gonna end up with Charlie Blackman up at some point in there too. I just don't see a way around that, but.
Well, the thing about Blackman is, even if, let's say worst case scenario, he gets hurt or something and is out like the rest of the season and never gets the call up, he's one of those players who will be added at the end anyway to, as a Rule 5 protectee. Mm. And along with Christian Friedrich and, then a couple other fringe, players that might be, protected from the Rule 5 there. But, you can pretty much count him as one of those players who will be on the roster by the end of the year.
Yeah, and he deserves it at this point, just dominating AAA, and he's been, kind of one of those second tier kind of guys, but then he kind of pushed his way up to the forefront in spring training this year and definitely was playing in the springs. And yeah, go Charlie Blackman, I guess. I guess a lot of it depends on how they handle Ryan Spielborg's roster spot.
Mm-hmm.
Because if he ends up, leaving the organization, he's a free agent after the season, correct?
No, as I've clarified before, his contract expires, but he's not going to have the service time to declare.
That's right.
So if we decide to let him go, then we non-tender him.
Yeah, and I honestly hate to say it because I love Ryan Spielborgs. Who doesn't love Ryan Spielborgs? If you don't love Ryan Spielborgs, probably not a Rockies fan. Anyways, Spilly, if he gets non-tendered, it wouldn't be the most shocking thing in the world to me. I don't necessarily think it's going to happen just because he's got the team history and everyone loves him and he's right-handed. And I'm not 100% sold on the idea of Cole Garner being able to slide right into Spielborg's spot.
Yeah, and I think at this point, further, it helps with the fact that I don't expect him to send Blackman straight into a bench role. I think the closest, quickest way he has of making the majors is if something serious happens to any of our starting outfielders, or Seth Smith goes downhill or something like that.
See, well, what's interesting with Smith is I kind of wonder how they would handle that next year, because, this year he's the guy. He's not just Mr. Late Night. He's finally proven all them naysayers wrong that say that he's not able to hold down a starting spot, because
And he stands out because there's a lot of players who aren't handling that quite as well as he is right now.
Especially the guys who are guaranteed their starting spots. But, mm-hmm. Next year, Seth Smith, hits the skids again. Or hits the skids might be the wrong terminology. It's close enough, whatever. If his bat falls apart for any reason next year, yeah, there's a good chance that he's done or this is a swan song. There'll be a lot of analysis on that if something like that happens. But I kind of wonder how the leash will be. If it'll be the leash that we saw in 2010 with Seth Smith, that was, come on, you can do it, you're not doing it, oh, let's try a cut, screw it, pull on the leash. It would take a collapse like that to probably get Blackman into the lineup, whereas, Smith might get the benefit of the doubt just from how, assuming he finishes the year with this kind of a line, that how good of a year he had in 2011.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now with Blackman's ascent there, I'm sure that a lot of people out there really want to see him really, pound his way onto the team in a significant capacity, but we should point out that we've had a lot of reasonably talented prospects that have hung around in AAA a couple of years before getting the call, and it's completely possible that he might not find that opportunity until a couple of years from now, too. So,
I don't think that's gonna be, I think the team will fight to get him up if he really is earning it, even if it takes till next year for them to give him more than the September call up, if he's making an undeniable claim to the spot, at least the roster spot, I don't think the team will necessarily just bring him in to be a fifth outfielder, because that would be a waste of guys who've been dominating.
But which the same, is- Which is basically what I was getting at, in that, you know, if Seth Smith continues to do well, we have those three spots sealed up. Blackman, unless he hits 450 all year, is not going to steal a spot from Carlos Gonzalez.
What I think will be interesting is if they don't trust Dexter Fowler against right-handers, you know, as a left-handed batter, what you could, I mean, and this would also require a little bit more flexibility from Jim Tracy. But, you know, if Blackman happened, I love how we're like theorizing, you know, what 2012's lineups might look like. But no, if you'd acquiesce to put Cargo back in center here and there, and you put, you know, either Smith, and this is again assuming everyone is performing and starting and all that, but, you know, Smith needed to slide to left and put Blackman in right or vice versa. But that would depend on, again, Jim Tracy not being Cargo's my left fielder, and that's the end of the story.
Well, he could theoretically just become the center fielder, and that's the end of the story.
I would like that too, because I'm also on board that the Seth Smith is a good outfielder bandwagon, and I think Blackman might be better over on the in the left field, you know, that monstrous left field manning the gap. But you know, either way, if the team gets creative enough, there's going to be plenty of ways to get Blackman into the lineup on a regular basis. Should one of our outfielders just completely fall apart, especially since we only have four real outfielders.
Right. Okay, so I have just two really quick more topics to go over. Give me your thoughts on, did you watch Juan Nicasio pitch?
You know, regrettably, and this sounds awful for the, you know, the editor to say, but this is the game that I was in Colorado Springs, so we can,
That's right, and that's funny, because that was the other thing I was going to talk about after this, but...
Alright, well, I went down, into Colorado Springs, I just picked a game, and I already had it all lined up, and then like the next day, Juan Nicasio getting the start, and then during the game, I'm getting all these texts from people who aren't even, you know, my regular baseball texty people, like, you know, I had a friend actually invite me to the game. I'm like, oh no, I'm going to be in the Springs. And he was texting me like, dude, you're missing a hell of a game. Yes, I get it. Thank you.
That's too bad.
Anyone following me on Twitter on Saturday got to see a lot of, what I was looking at out there. But, more importantly, Fisher tweeted at me and said, hey, you're missing a great game in Coors Field. I said, yes, thank you, Andrew. I know I am missing a great game. Beautiful. I don't know.
That's too bad. I didn't get to see it either, unfortunately. I was otherwise occupied at the moment.
I seem to miss every gigantic offensive bludgeoning. Like when they had that monster sitting against the Cubs, I was out with family or friends or something like that, and I get a text from you know, one of my friends, and she says, I love baseball. Why? Well, the Rockies just put up more than 9 runs in the eighth, whatever that ginormous number was. You gotta be kidding me. Anyways, let me give me your thoughts on Nicasio, because honestly, I saw the line and I was impressed with what I saw, but, you know, obviously it was one and done.
Well, again, I didn't see much of anything. I did watch, like, you know how MLB.com does, like, these montages and their highlights if somebody has a good outing? They had one for Nicasio, and I did watch that. You know, look pretty much like what we would expect. You know, the hope with him is that, he continues as he raises through the organization, or ascends through the organization. He keeps the walks down. And so far this season, he's been very good at that. So he looked like he had reasonable control. And of course, you know, when a person makes their MLB debut and is not getting hit around, you know, at least they're not like freaking out.
Yeah. I mean, the command obviously wasn't going to be complete best quality, because, you know, one, it's his first start in, you know, the majors, his first anything in the majors, and it was a Saturday night game, super, all that. I mean, you got that to think about, plus just the fact that he's not ready. I mean, I don't mean that in a how dare you call up Juan Nicasio kind of way. I mean, it's done, and I wasn't a giant fan of it to begin with, but Fisher kind of talked me down off a cliff. And basically, we got a decent start out of him. And
yeah, he did fantastic. It was excellent.
A couple of our users pointed out, they said, good, now send him, I'm okay with him sending him back down, because now he can go back with all the pride in the world, like, I, you know, threw, you know, 5 innings of great baseball in the majors, and I'm going to continue to kick the Texas League's ass right now.
Of course, there are also the people who are saying, like, hand him a rotation spot, he deserves another start. He's still, ninth on the starting pitching depth chart right now?
I don't know. I wonder how far he jumps up after that one good start, though, because, you know, if we're looking to call him back up, we'll be looking for a guy to be the guy rather than just to take a couple bullets.
Well, I will say that the start absolutely raises his long-term depth, but I don't know if the current, this moment depth has really changed all that much. For example, I don't think that they're going to consider him for taking over for the rest of the season in the rotation, for example. At least not after that one start. If he ends up long-term in the rotation later in the season, it's going to be for other reasons than just the one start, basically. So,
obviously. I figured the one start kind of... I mean, there's no way that everyone in the world wasn't watching him. You know, as far as the Rockies world goes, to say, you know, all right, what can we see? Does he deserve a jump up to AAA? I say just keep him in the Texas League, personally.
I think he's going to get that promotion mid-season, though.
To the majors or AAA?
To AAA.
And I wouldn't be surprised by that either, because, you know, I like the idea of keeping him in AA just so he can, not necessarily even for confidence issues, although that might be part of it, but... You know, being the kind of guy who, again, I don't want to say came out of nowhere, because as a lot of our farmhands like to say, they've been, you know, he's one of those guys who had a lot of potential that they kind of had to slowly unpeel like an onion to really be able to find, or, you know, like a great artichoke heart or some food analogy in that regard.
And he's one of those players like Esmil Rogers was, who had to be protected when he was just an A-level player. It's real easy when you have the American types who go straight into the American organization and don't sign when they're, you know, 16 or 17 years old. Of course, Nicasio didn't either. He signed late. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is when you sign a contract even to play in the Dominican League or in one of the other Latin academies, you're still on that clock. And when Nicasio was in A-ball, that's when the team had to make the decision, do we protect this guy?
Now, is it a number of years or is it your age that makes you Rule 5 eligible?
It is both. Okay.
Well, it's a number of years if you start at a certain age and a different number of years if you start at a different age, right?
Exactly. The easy way to think of it is, and it's when you sign your contract that age is dictated. If you were 18 in the year, but signed your contract when you're 19, which is what happened to Nicasio, then you don't get that extra year. So basically, after four seasons, you are eligible if you were 19 or older when you signed, and it's 5 years if you're 18 or younger when you signed.
Okay.
Which is why a player like Parker Frazier, for example, was not Rule 5 eligible last year, but will be this year. Because he was 18 when he signed.
Interesting. It'll be interesting to see if a guy like Parker Frazier gets protected. Anyways, we were talking about Nicasio and his depth role. you were right that he probably will get a AAA promotion. It's probably not a bad idea, again, for a guy who is not the surefire ace lock kind of prospect to, you know, all right, let's see what he does at, you know, a more unfriendly hitter's altitude.
And
pitcher's altitude, I mean.
Plus, I mean, there's nobody in the current Sky Sox rotation who should hold back any prospect. It's not going to be hard at all to release any of those guys.
Which is sad to say, but yeah.
Yeah, and again, somebody somewhere just got really mad at me. We don't say these things to be jerks. It was just from a depth perspective. The point is, Claudio Vargas is not going to be a priority over Juan Nicasio if they think Nicasio deserves a spot in Colorado Springs at any point during the year.
It's kind of funny, just as a bit of a cynical side note. We have taken flack over the last couple years for the occasional offhand, you know, kind of almost dehumanizing comment. I recall that during spring training, the Rockies were playing the Dodgers, shut them out for 8 innings,
Is this the Chris Malone thing?
This is Chris Malone, yeah. And I forgot the name of the other pitching prospect, but, I referred to, the other guy whose name I have forgotten, and that's probably going to catch me double flack. I can't even remember the guys I'm making fun of. But I referred to him as a local pizza delivery guy, and then I referred to Chris Malone as Carl Malone, and that's why the Dodgers were able to rough the come back and win in a walk-off fashion. And
it might have been Andrew Johnston who you called the pizza delivery guy. That sounds familiar.
We caught a decent amount of flack over that. It was meant lightheartedly because, you know, everyone gets made fun of here and there, and I just thought it was, you know, after a bunch of rabid fans who want to read stuff, maybe just make a couple jokes. And,
well, and
yeah, we do think that everybody in the organization has their shot and has their potential and shouldn't be looked at as just a washout. But, you know, at some point we got to face stark reality. Like Tyler Massanari, I believe that's his.
Bryce Massanari.
Bryce, thank you. I knew it was a Y name, but been dominating Asheville. He's also 24. You're in the Sally League at age 24. Something tells me that Jose Morales' job is safe for now. These are the cold realities of a lot of these kind of things. And I would like to see Massanari, you know, make a jump to, you know, Modesto or Tulsa sometime soon here. And, you know, once again, prove me wrong, but
yeah,
you know, we organizational guys are organizational guys. And I think a lot of them are very aware of it, but they're going to try to buck off that mantle. But, just saying.
Yeah, the easy way to look at it from our perspective is we're rooting for all of them. We just know that not all of them are going to make it, and some are more likely to make it than others. And it's more of an attempt at an objective assessment than personal ridicule of their position.
It's not very fun to have to look at a guy and say, well, that guy's not going to go. I mean, no one takes pride necessarily in saying, Delta Cleary Jr., you'll never make it. You know, and I guess maybe he has his arch villain out there who has his page bookmarked and is, you know, cackling while rubbing his hands together every time he has an 0-for game.
Well,
it'd be kind of funny to think that every minor league baseball player has some sort of, you know, menacing childhood rival who's following their career.
that one player on, like, their high school team who was, like, second best to them.
Yeah, like, did you ever see the movie Meet the Robinsons?
Yes, I did not like that movie.
See, I loved it, absolutely.
I remember reading about that on your Facebook page. You were a big fan. I will reserve this discussion for my eventual film podcast, so continue.
Bring me on and we'll argue over the sappiness and silliness of it. Anyways, point is that this kid was an inventor and he's an orphan and shares a bunk bed with another kid who plays baseball and the inventor kid's up all night making an invention and it, ends up keeping the kid up all night, the baseball player kid. And then they're in the championship game and he's asleep in left field and he doesn't even see the fly ball coming because he's asleep and he gets yelled at and they lose the game. And he harbors it his entire life and ends up becoming, you know, the menacing villain with the long sharp mustache and the bowler hat. I figure every single Major League Baseball player needs a guy like that who just kind of haunts their life. It's a bit creepy to think about, but at the same time, I think it's kind of funny. It'll teach them to learn how to deal with adversity fast.
Okay, really quickly, I wanted to ask you about you had mentioned you were at the AAA game. The game you were at happened to be Aaron Cook's presumably final rehab start, and I wanted to know what, if any impressions you got from what you saw.
Well, it was an interesting lineup that day. We had Jacobs at first, Emos at second, and Radames Nazario got the start at shortstop over Chris Nelson.
He was just recently promoted from extended spring training.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, at that point in time, he was a scratch for that reason, but I was kind of hoping to see. It was actually funny because Brandon Belt had just got the promotion to the majors as well for the Giants, and they were playing the Sky Sox were playing the Fresno Grizzlies. So instead of seeing Brandon Belt at first, which I would have really, really liked to see, I instead got to see Brad Eldred.
Yeah.
So that was entertaining in its own way. But Matt McCree, or it's either Matt Cree or McCree. We talked about this for a moment. The Sky Sox PA called him McCree, and Greg's saying that he heard on the Sky Sox radio feed that it was Macri. So if I ever meet him and get to shake his hand, I will ask him how his name is pronounced.
There you go. Permanent answer. You would think that he would know.
I would hope so. Left field is Cole Garner, which is to be expected, and right field is Charles Blackman. Center field is Jeff Salazar, which I wasn't terribly thrilled with until he hit a walk-off home run.
And
so,
if I recall, that was, what, his second home run of the game?
Yeah, it was. I was like, wow, where did Jeff Salazar? I remember screaming, it's into the night! Because it had gotten all dark by then, and the ball just sails off into the black oblivion.
Right.
It was kind of, you know, very cinematic. Anyways, Aaron Cook got the start, and Matt Pagnozzi was catching him. And, you know, Cook looked all right. He gave up a couple gopher balls to the same guy, which was just no good. It, you know, we can't handle seeing, that kind of, you know, granted it's Colorado Springs, and he had a couple, you know, weak flyouts, but then two homers, and they were pretty much no doubters. I'm pretty sure those balls, the way they were struck, would have been hit for homers in the majors as well. It was, line shots over the left field wall, and those are going to clear the wall in Coors Field too. Mm-hmm. Anyways, but the good thing was that a lot of the time we saw him keeping the ball down in the zone. He wasn't sailing strikes for the most part. A lot of ground balls. Like, easily a 2 or 3 to 1 ratio of ground balls to flyouts. And he had one inning where he got a bit wild. He was, you know, sailing pitches a bit, and they were able to start dinking him for, yeah, and it was the same kind of thing. You saw balls just make it past the infield and just fall in no man's land and stuff like that. But we also saw some strong liners to the wall and obviously those two home runs. So actual, like, baseball slash line results, not a great start. But at the same time, I don't think he walked anyone. I believe he walked one guy in the game. And past that, it was, you know, a lot of balls in play and a lot of ground balls. And that's, honestly, don't walk guys and get ground balls. That's all we really care about for Aaron Cook, and just hope the rest of it turns out all right, you know? As for the rest of the game, let me think if there's anything interesting to notice. Cole Garner had a nice big triple in a clutch situation, and the game went to extras, and I got to see one cool thing. I missed it when I went out to L.A. last year with Musia, and we saw a Nationals and Dodgers game. In the ninth inning, the Dodgers had a runner to third with less than, it was either one out or zero outs. So they brought their right fielder behind second base and had a 5-man infield all playing real tight in there. Cause anything over anybody's head is gonna score the run from third likely.
Right.
So they just figure, whatever, let's just make sure if it's in the infield, we get it. And, this actually ended up happening with the Sky Sox as well. With one out, they had a runner on third and they brought their right fielder standing right behind second base and the play worked cause the ensuing batter, I forgot who was batting next. I was disappointed in him. However, he just bounced one to third base, and they were running a stupid contact play, and the runner takes off from third and gets thrown out by a mile at home. He went for the home plate collision, and you know nothing as horrifying as the Buster Posey or Carlos Santana collision. It was one of those. I'm just going to drop a shoulder and run into you and hopefully you drop the ball. There's no awkward positioning. It was very, you know, runner and linebacker kind of situation. So that didn't work out. Next batter struck out. That's into the inning. Goes to the 10th inning. Eliezer Alfonso, first one of the plate, he's batting like 360 this season. He loses his bat into the crowd, comes flying right at me, and I just kind of freeze, and I'm kind of ready for it, you know, to descend into my seat and hold my glove up and just try to bat it away and grab it. Bounce goes right over our heads, bounces off the head of the girl in the row behind us.
Wow.
Not like, you know, straight on, thunk, dead, nothing horrifying like that. It seemed to more skip off her head. I thought it actually hit the seat. She had shrunk down into her seat to avoid it. Mm-hmm. But no, it just bounced off the crown of her head, and, you know, she looked like she was all right, just, you know. Really shaken up. Maybe, yeah. I mean, maybe something like a concussion, but she wasn't bleeding or anything like that, and there were paramedics dealing with for her, so.
Well, that's good.
I hope she's all right, and I know Eliezer Alfonso felt awful about it, because, I mean, we know Willie Taveras did this in 2008, threw a bat in the stands and hit someone and, you know, met with a family after the game and said I'm sorry and signed a bunch of crap for him, and they knew it was an accident, but, you know, good on Taveras for, you know, being that conscientious of it. And I'm same thing with Alfonso. I don't know if he actually, you know, did anything to make recompense, but, you know, they're not going to, they have hearts. Anyways, so he strikes out in that at bat, which is very disappointing. And then Jeff Salazar comes up and hits the second home run of the game, gets the mosh pit at home plate, and then the Sky Sox get fireworks. Aw, yeah.
Cool. Sounds like a good time.
It was a good game. They were down like 5-1 at one point, and then down 6-5, and then they tied it at 7, and then 8-7 final.
Now, just to go back to that play that you described before, I was reading through, I usually read through the play-by-play recap stuff for each of the minor games just to keep track of everything, and I noticed at one point, it was Travis Ishikawa in right field, right?
Yes.
And Brad Eldred at first.
Yes.
So I noticed that I think on the play that you were speaking of, the box score person was a little confused because he didn't, I mean, presumably, even though your right fielder is not in right field, he's still the right fielder. You don't just create a new position that goes in that spot.
Yeah.
But he was confused because what ended up happening was that game day said that Travis Ishikawa moved to first base for the play and Brad Eldred moved to right.
And that's obviously a mistake there.
And then on the next batter they switched. So when I read that, I was trying to think, like, is there a reason that, like, they wanted Ishikawa at first for this particular batter? But,
he's a good first baseman from what I've heard, but, you know, come on, you don't know.
That does clarify what happened there. Right. So, we've got, we filled up the hour pretty much. So, unless you've got anything else, I think we're going to head out of here.
I still have a headache.
And I still, have so much work to do tonight to get this up and ready for everybody. So
You're a hero, Greg.
If only you paid me for it.
Hey, I pay you something.
Yeah, I guess.
Everyone gets something.
I guess it's better than nothing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
If only you paid me a full-time salary.
Oh God, if I could pay you a full-time salary, I would have a full-time salary as well, Greg.
Yes, and we would make this podcast really epic, and we would buy interviews with all the important baseball players, and
I might have press credentials.
So with that, I am going to sign off for today. We will be back next week. It is going to be June 6th, and until then, on behalf of us, take care.